In Islam, forgiveness is arbitrary. In Christianity, it is in perfect keeping with God's exorbitant, excessive, and extravagant grace.
Hank Hanegraaff of the Bible Answer Man, speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And while neither Sunni nor Shia are monolithic respecting details of their end-time scenarios, they are united in reducing Jesus to the administrative deputy of Muhammad and thoroughly human associate of the Muslim Mahdi. Jesus is demoted from the creator of all things, including Muhammad, to a mere caste member in the Muslim eschatological charade.
You can listen to Making the Case Against Islam with Hank Hanegraaff on an audio DVD or thumb drive of our 2018 Making the Case conferences. We'll send it to you for a financial gift of $300. Order today at issuesetc.org.
I spoke to Congresswoman McSally this evening, and I'm grateful for her service. We both ran for the Senate for the same reason, because we want what's best for Arizona and for our country.
That's an excerpt from Democratic Representative Kyrsten Sinema's acceptance speech last night as Arizona's newly elected U.S. Senator. Many people are reeling after that. There was a state where that Senate seat was held by Republicans for 30 years. What has changed in Arizona? What, if anything, has changed, indicated by the numbers coming out of the midterm elections? I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're going to be talking about those midterm election results. Joining us to do so on this Tuesday afternoon, Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
And Molly Hemingway, Fox News contributor and senior editor at The Federalist. Molly, welcome.
Great to be here with you.
For both of you, but for you first, Molly, how do you explain the Democrats winning a seat in Arizona that they haven't managed to hold in 30 years?
I think it's a lot of reasons. I think the left was very organized and excited to vote this year, and Sinema ran a very good campaign, the Democratic candidate. McSally, on the other hand, didn't run a very exciting campaign, and she suffered from some of the internal problems that the GOP is having. She was in pretty strong alliance with the previous or the outgoing senators, McCain and Flake, and they're in the Never Trump caucus. And then when she tried to correct that by embracing Trump, I think it ended up making people on both sides not totally excited to vote for her. And then I think that you also have to factor in the huge impact that immigration has had on voting populations, and that the influx as a result of immigration, and also maybe depending on how that is handled in the state, also was a factor.
What do you make of it, Mark?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things going on there, but the main thing is, and Molly kind of hinted at this, is just that Sinema ran an exceptionally good campaign, and McSally didn't run a very good campaign. McSally had previously won two, you know, congressional elections that were decided by something like 1% of the vote. She's about to lose this election by, you know, 2% of the vote in, you know, an exceptionally favorable year for Democrats. Further, for a Democrat, Sinema, despite, you know, the fact that she was quite the progressive radical, 10, 15 years ago, she, in her time in the House, she's been quite moderate. I mean, she has a voting record to back that up. I mean, she voted with Trump about 60% of the time. She ran a campaign that was explicitly pro-military, pro-gun, and backed Trump's calls to send troops to the border publicly. So, you know, she didn't come off as the progressive radical that the McSally campaign that tried to portray her as. And, you know, further, the difference is just simply, I think, that Sinema put in the work. I mean, she really, you know, reached out across the state, and McSally, you know, kind of focused on trying to get the margins she needed out of Maricopa County and didn't exactly excite the base in the more conservative parts of the state in the way that she needed to.
I'm reading from NBC News, Molly, a headline. Kyrsten Sinema makes history as first bisexual member of the U.S. Senate. The first paragraph reads this way: in addition to a win for Democrats, Sinema's hard-fought victory also adds to the spoils of the so-called rainbow wave that ushered in a record number of LGBTQ political candidates this year. What do you make of the media's and this term, the rainbow wave?
Well, first off, I think it's interesting that this was a headline only after she had secured her victory. It was not something that was highlighted during the campaign. And in general, the rather radical positions or posturing of the candidate were hidden by many people in the media or downplayed. There were a lot of reasons to be concerned about Sinema, including, someone's voice support for an American going and joining the Taliban to fight the American military forces. That's a pretty radical position, but in our media environment, such radical positions are treated or downplayed, treated kindly. And so this, I thought, was interesting that it showed up after the election was over. As for a rainbow wave, I'm more concerned about the use of wave to some extent to describe minor political victories. Wave usually refers to a massive sweep, overtaking of elections and whatnot. And all told, the Democrats gained 30-some seats in the House. That's far fewer than Barack Obama's Democratic Party lost in his first midterm election, 67 seats in the House alone, and more in the Senate. And this idea that there was some kind of wave when we're talking about just a few dozen seats that switched, I think, is politically indefensible.
Do you think, Molly, that they're just looking for something? If they couldn't have a blue wave, they want to have some kind of wave to talk about?
Yeah, I think it was very frustrating for people. Like, the last 2 years, we've had rhetoric of such an extreme type that, Donald Trump is beyond the pale, and that anyone who supports Donald Trump is beyond the pale. So if you have that type of media coverage and rhetoric going for 2 years nonstop with increasing alarm, and in the end, his party actually gains seats in the Senate, gives him more power to appoint judges, and does fairly well historically in the first midterms, that totally destroys the narrative. And so I think you're seeing people sort of try to rewrite what happened. I'm sure both parties had reason to be happy and be sad last Tuesday, but the fact that it was a split decision instead of a complete rout is very frustrating to the overall story that the media want to be telling.
I think we said this in our pre-election interview last week, but I mean, it probably needs to be said again. I think there are twice in over the last century that there have been presidents that didn't lose seats in Congress by a noticeable margin in their first midterm election. I mean, the American public generally likes divided government to some extent and wants, a check on power. And if you look at the election results last week, it was totally within the range of expected outcomes. It was totally within the sort of the historic norm of, what a president would be expected to, lose seats, even with the House flipping. I mean, it was not a repudiation of Donald Trump. And the way that, as Molly said, the media has set up this thing such that, anything less than a massive blue wave, isn't going to be the repudiation they were looking for. They're trying to rewrite things sort of after the fact. And just to go back to your point about the rainbow wave or whatever they're calling about, this stuff is just so ridiculous. And, Molly's right about the double standards. If you have a whiff of, biblical or orthodox beliefs on human sexuality, the media tries to portray you as some sort of radical. But then, there are certain things that happen that they just are invisible. The first Korean-American woman was elected to Congress in California last Tuesday. You haven't heard a word about Ms. Young Kim because she's a Republican. So, media is awfully selective about what they choose to portray as diversity. The reality is if the Republican Party is much more diverse than they're given credit for, especially these days. They're becoming more diverse, just like America is becoming more diverse. And the fact that this is only a thing that happens for Democrats is really quite something.
Molly, can you give us an update on the Senate and the gubernatorial race in Florida?
Yeah, so on election night, it looked like Ron DeSantis had won his race to be the next governor of Florida. He's a Republican over Andrew Gillum. And that Bill Nelson had lost his attempt to be reelected in Florida. He's a Democrat who's running against the current governor, Rick Scott. And it was by a traditionally Floridian narrow margin. And that's when things started to get interesting, as they always do in Florida. There are 2 to 3 counties that always have trouble counting ballots in very suspicious ways. They are Miami-Dade, which actually did fine this time, Broward and Palm Beach counties. Broward and Palm Beach counties both violated the law and the state constitution by failing to report how many ballots were left to count. And just this is sort of electioneering 101 or election vote counting 101. At the end of when the polls close, you need to say how many votes remain to be counted if you haven't counted them all. And the reason why is because other people need to know that you're not destroying ballots or inventing ballots. And so if you don't have the actual number, it makes it very easy to play with those numbers in a way that makes people not have confidence. So they both violated the law by not saying how many ballots they had, by failing to update every 45 minutes as required by law. And there were also other problems, like one of the people who supervises the election in that county admitted that she counted 22 illegal ballots because she didn't know, she accidentally mixed them with legal ballots, and she didn't want to remove the 200 or so legal ballots just because she was a mess, she had messed up and included these 22 other ballots. So even by her own admission, she was counting illegal ballots. And so Rick Scott in particular was sounding the alarm, Marco Rubio, various other Republicans. There are problems, the kind that we've grown accustomed to in these counties in Florida. And so what was interesting was to see that the way the media responded to it was as if these people were crazy for having a problem with these violations of the law and of the Constitution. Even though multiple judges had found that they were in violation of the law, the general media approach was to say these crazy people down in Florida are making claims without evidence of problems with their voting down there. Well, it's not without evidence. It's with a lot of evidence. And if people care about election integrity as much as they claim to, everyone should be unified in their desire to make sure that only legal votes are counted and that all the legal votes are counted in a timely fashion.
I think it should also be just, you know, noted that it seems very likely that both the Republicans, DeSantis for governor and Scott for the Senate, Republicans, the Republican for the Senate seat, are more than likely to win their elections. Last I looked, Scott was up by Nelson by something like 13,000 votes, and DeSantis had a significantly higher margin than that. Those aren't, you know, numbers that you're typically overturned in recounts. You recall the last big recount where they upended the result was 10 years ago in the Minneapolis Senate race when Al Franken won by a few hundred votes after, you know, I think he was down 1,000 or something in, on Election Day. So it seems very likely, despite all the shenanigans, that Republicans are going to win, and it's all the more frustrating that the Broward people and other things wouldn't act, you know, professionally or competently in light of that. But, it sure does seem suspicious what they were doing.
Mark Hemingway is senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and Molly Hemingway is Fox News contributor and senior editor at The Federalist. When we come back, we're going to talk about Mississippi's Senate runoff election and the current party breakdown total of the U.S. Senate before the election results in Florida and Mississippi. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're looking at the midterm election results. Stay tuned.
Well, a human nature is what makes you human and not a dog or a fish or a turtle. Your human nature is what sets your ultimate capacities and determines the kind of thing you are. You don't get a human nature in degrees. You either have it or you don't. There's no degree involved.
Scott Klusendorf speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
Well, people today are quite willing to concede that you have a human nature. They're willing to concede I do, but they don't want to concede that embryo is. And here's the question you put to them when they challenge you. How do two human parents create offspring that isn't human, but later becomes so?
You can listen to Scott Klusendorf's presentation, Making the Case for Life, and all the speakers at our 2018 Making the Case conferences on an audio DVD or flash drive. We'll send it to you for a $300 year-end tax-deductible donation. Look for the link at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Concordia University Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're committed to increasing LCMS faculty and staff members. This is Dr. Daniel Gard, president of Concordia University Chicago. If you are a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod with excellent professional credentials, please consider applying for our faculty or staff family. Current openings are posted at cuchicago.edu/HR.
For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, This child, Jesus Christ, is the focus of every Christmas card that Emmanuel Press offers. Whether in stained glass, illumination, or classic works of art, Christmas cards from Emmanuel Press joyfully confess our Savior's birth with the words of Scripture and the poetry of hymns. Visit their website at emmanuelpress.us to create a custom assortment of cards. EmmanuelPress.us.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Molly Hemingway, a Fox News contributor and senior editor at The Federalist, and Mark Hemingway, senior writer for The Weekly Standard, about the midterm election results. Molly, what can you tell us about Mississippi's Senate runoff election?
Yeah, Mississippi has an interesting situation where they frequently head to runoffs if candidates don't get more than 50%. And so there's a Republican woman named Cindy Hyde Smith running against Mike Espy, the Democratic challenger, who's the former congressman and former U.S. Agriculture Secretary. So I think most people expect that the Republican will win that race, but of course it will be well-funded and hard-fought. But that one's probably a Republican pickup, which will mean that Republicans have 53 seats in the House at the end of the midterms, since also the Florida seat is flipping to the Republicans.
So, Mark, if we omit for the moment Florida and Mississippi, what is the current party breakdown total of the U.S. Senate? How does it look right now?
It's 51 Republicans and 47 Democrats.
What does that mean if we add in the results that Molly just talked about? What picture emerges for the Republicans in the U.S.?
Well, having an extra cushion of seats, you know, means a lot of things. But primarily what it means is it makes it easier to sort of get more conservative legislation. And what is key is getting more conservative judges through. I mean, a lot of what happened with, you know, sort of the Kavanaugh controversy and other things like that was, you know, because Republicans had to sort of play nice and make sure that Susan Collins of Maine and, you know, Jeff Flake and some of the other more liberal Republican senators, you know, had their wishes sort of addressed at every step of the process. In the end, I think that ended up being a good thing in that particular circumstance. But if, say, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, hopefully she's, you know, it stays fine, but she is getting up there in years. If something happens to her soon and we need to replace her seat tomorrow, that'll, if Republicans want to nominate a more conservative justice or someone that doesn't have the reputation for being sort of as a middle of the road and centrist as Kavanaugh did, which, believe it or not, was a thing before the rape accusations, then it'll be a lot easier to get the Republicans in the Senate behind that confirmation. There was some talk about the reason why Trump nominated Kavanaugh as opposed to Amy Coney Barrett, for instance, which was that he actually thought that Kavanaugh would be easier to get through because he would be more appealing to the liberal or more centrist Republicans in the Senate, like Susan Collins and Jeff Flake. Whereas, you know, with a couple extra seats here of cushion, getting through a justice who has a reputation for being more overtly conservative in their jurisprudence should be a lot easier.
Molly, if the Democrats hadn't started the war on the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh as they did, do you think that they might have regained the Senate?
I think it was a strategic blunder on their part. It made sense why they were trying to do it. They could at best thwart getting this, you know, seat done, and they had a long shot chance to get the Senate. It would have demoralized Republican voters. In fact, the exact opposite happened. I think it energized Republican voters and reminded everybody why the Senate is so important as it's currently set up. Mark just made the excellent points about how important judges are. It's also true that the Senate and our House of Representatives are kind of broken when it comes to doing other things like passing legislation. What the Senate is really good for now is getting good judges in or bad judges and filling the executive branch, consenting to whoever the president nominates. They're not very good at actually passing legislation or dealing with big other problems, but that is the way that is the situation as it stands. And so having that extra cushion is very key and was a huge strategic blunder for the Democrats.
To more specifically address what you were saying, I'd have to do some back of the envelope math to really like confirm how much it would have improved Democrats' chances of retaking the Senate. But I mean, I do think that if you look at what happened there, Joe Manchin was the only Democrat who voted in support of Kavanaugh, and he cruised to re-election. And of the remaining vulnerable Democratic senators that were up for election, the only one of them that voted against Kavanaugh and won his election was Tester in Montana. And if you look at the rest of the map, you can see, you know, like Heitkamp in North Dakota, Donnelly in Indiana, they voted against Kavanaugh. And there's no question in my mind that voting against Kavanaugh was a big reason why that they lost. So, yeah, I mean, it definitely hurt Democrat Senate tally to come out against Kavanaugh the way that they did.
Molly, many pundits are saying that health care and the president's behavior are the primary reasons why college-educated women voted Democratic. Do you agree?
I think that actually is probably a good assessment, just because that's what people are reporting, that they cared a lot about health care. I would say health care and the president's behavior played a role in what happened. Democrats voted Democratic, Republicans voted Republican, and so we're really interested in who switched. And there are two interesting groups of people who've switched their votes in recent years. One are people who traditionally voted Democrat, who live in the Midwest and a lot of places, like in different states in the Midwest, who are more middle class, who felt like the Democratic Party had abandoned their interests, and they became enthusiastic Trump supporters, and they were willing to go ahead and give Republicans a shot that they hadn't been willing to give because of how they behaved in recent years. The other group of switcheroos are people who are more socially liberal, who were happy to vote for Republicans of a more moderate nature, and who turned on the Republican Party as it embraced Trump. And both of those realignments are interesting. I actually was on the Acela train last week coming down from New York when Jerry Nadler, who's the incoming chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, the Democrat leader of that committee, and he was lamenting to someone he was talking on the phone with about this switch. He didn't like losing lower class or middle class voters and replacing them with elite Republican women. He thought that was bad branding for the party, that he doesn't think the Democratic Party can claim to be the party of the working class when really it's just a bunch of elite former Republicans. He called them Rockefeller Republicans who have joined with them. But be that as it may, that's what the situation is. And so we're witnessing that realignment. And I think it'll be very interesting to see how it fleshes out and how the parties respond to that realignment and how they talk about issues that matter to them.
So, Mark, since we have a Democratic-controlled House and Republican-controlled Senate, is it likely that we'll see any legislation passed in the next 2 years?
That's an interesting question because, you know, you have to remember that Donald Trump was a Democrat up until, you know, not that long ago and was writing checks to Democrats and didn't exactly come across as someone who was, you know, Mr. Conservative. And he was certainly, even when he campaigned for president, you know, he talked a lot about, you know, compromise and working together with Democrats. So, you know, if Trump sees it being politically advantageous to partner with Democrats to get something done, he might just do that. I think the question is more is whether or not the crazy liberal Democratic base will let Democrats work with Trump, or will they see that as a betrayal? I mean, there are certainly issues here where Donald Trump, you know, since the beginning of his campaign, hasn't exactly been, you know, super conservative. Certainly his healthcare rhetoric and other things like that has not been of a guy that thinks that, you know, free markets are needed to, you know, help make healthcare more cost effective and efficient. So, and healthcare, for instance, is a big issue for Democrats in this election. I could, you know, foresee a situation here where, you know, Trump thought that, you know, say partnering with Democrats on a pivotal issue like pre-existing conditions or something like that, would be advantageous politically and might just do it. But, you know, the question is whether or not the Democrats have so demonized Trump that the Democratic voters won't let them do that.
Is Nancy Pelosi going to be Speaker of the House?
It sounds like she's going to be Speaker of the House, at least in the short term, simply because Democrats, for whatever reason, are so disorganized and just don't have another good alternative. But yeah, there are a lot of rumblings and a lot of discontent about her leadership in recent years. And it's sort of astonishing to me that Democrats haven't gotten their act together better in terms of party leadership, because she'll be a real foil for Trump. And, you know, if Trump thrives on having foils that he gets to, you know, beat up in the media, and Pelosi was certainly not exactly someone who's liked by the American public and, you know, could be really advantageous for Trump to have her in that position.
Can we expect the president to run hard against the House for the next 2 years?
Well, it depends what the House does. You know, if they legislate rather than spend all their time, you know, trying to legislate rather than spend all their time on, you know, fruitless investigations into, you know, Russia and other things like that, then it'll be a lot harder to do that. If they take a very obstructionist route and then they take too hard a liberal line on certain issues like immigration and some other things, then, you know, it's very possible that Trump will do very well having them as a foil and running against them.
It is, most people are wondering about two of these justices. You mentioned Justice Ginsburg. There's also Justice Byers as well. How hard is it going to be for Trump to get the a nominee through if he has an opportunity in the next 2 years?
Well, it'll be a lot easier because of the extra Senate cushion that we discussed, certainly. So, I mean, I don't anticipate, you know, it being, you know, as a matter of legislative mechanics, any harder than it was this last time. The question is if you saw the reaction to Kavanaugh and what they did to him, and as some guy who seemed very centrist, very much within the normal Republican mold, question is what are they going to do? I mean, you know, they might just move heaven and earth to save RBG's seat. You know, and you have to remember that in terms of the balance of the court, Kavanaugh was, you know, replacing, you know, a somewhat conservative justice, despite Republicans' frustration with him. If they're replacing what is viewed as a progressive RBG seat on the court with a very conservative justice, you know, who knows what they're going to unleash.
Molly, with about 30 seconds here, if you were asked, and I am asking you now, to characterize these midterms in terms of expectation of a wave or maybe a victory on the part of the Republicans in holding off a wave, the president's role in all of that, how would you summarize it?
Well, this really was a split decision, and it shows that America is a very polarized and divided nation. It's harder to win Senate seats because, by definition, those are statewide versus House districts, but it looks like we might see this kind of thing happening in the future again, even in 2 years. I wouldn't be surprised if Republicans pick up another couple Senate seats or hold their own or, you know, do a little bit better, and that Democrats continue to eat away in suburban districts. So I think it's time for people to realize this is the new normal, that we are this divided and that we need politicians to address that and be honest about those divisions and get a little bit out of the moldy thinking that had dominated the past several decades. And that's a much bigger issue than Donald Trump. That's something that both parties have to realize. He won't be around forever, and these problems and issues are going to remain.
You can read Mark and Molly Hemingway's columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor and senior editor at The Federalist. Molly, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And Mark Hemingway is senior writer for The Weekly Standard. Mark, keep up the good work.
Thanks again.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss Christ fulfilling the law in our Lutheran Catechesis series with Pastor Peter Bender. We'll be talking about how Christ has come to not only give the law, that he did in the Old Testament, but also the one who would keep the law in our place. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.